You can bring a gun to a protest, and it shouldn't cost you your life, no matter what anyone in the Trump administration says. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine and Friends. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward and Matt Welch, as well as very special guest and Reason versus debate victor, Emily Jashinsky. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. All right. So over the weekend, as you have almost certainly heard, Alex Preti, a 37-year-old ICU nurse, was shot and killed by immigration enforcement agents in Minneapolis. He was filming their activity. He was carrying a gun for which he had a permit. Trump officials have said he was an assassin, a domestic terrorist who intended to cause maximum carnage. And I just think that if you look at the evidence, it's really clear they're lying. And not only are they're lying in service of a really just awful idea. And it's the idea that it was reasonable, maybe even justified, for masked agents of the state to execute this man face down in the street just for showing up to a protest while carrying a gun, both of which are constitutionally protected rights. Emily, I just want to ask, what do you think of the administration's argument here that this was brought on by Preti's decision to carry a gun to the protest, and also the way that the officials have kind of prejudged this and pre-spun a narrative before there has been any investigation, exactly the same playbook we saw with Rene Good?
Yeah, I mean, Kristi Noem got out right on Saturday afternoon, so did Attorney General Pam Bondi, and we're pointing the finger squarely at Preti. And in such, you know, to the point you just made, I'm trying to kind of separate two different things. One is this question of how the administration has discussed the firearm, and then the other is what actually happened. And their discussion of the firearm has been infuriating. Like, if you are a gun owner, I mean, even if you're, some folks were just in the Virginia state capitol doing a, if, remember what happened in Michigan in 2020, people were open carrying at the state house. And the reason that people on the right do that is because the Second Amendment is important to the First Amendment. And we all kind of know that. We all kind of understand that. So repeatedly, specifically invoking the fact that he had two magazines, invoking the fact that he was armed at all, even though it was all legal and it was permitted in accordance, at least it appears as of now, with Minnesota state law. It's outrageous. It's offensive. It was a huge mistake. I think they're going to try to move the goalposts on that a little bit. The attorney, the U.S. attorney, interim U.S. attorney, who got way out ahead of his skis on Saturday, has already started to try and walk back his point and just say what he was saying was that it was unwise. But the last thing I'll point out is, if you have a, let's say, a mass shooting or a seriously dangerous event at a protest, and you have two magazines, and you are legally carrying your firearm, and you're a good guy with a gun that stops the violence and puts an end to what could be an even worse tragedy, the right is going to champion you and call you a hero. And I agree with that. And so I think they just started invoking 2A here because this guy was a liberal.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, look, I have made on this podcast the argument that at times it can be unwise, it can be intentionally provocative to carry a weapon to a protest. I think that's true. That's not a crazy argument to make. But then to say that that in any way justifies what we can all see on multiple videos from multiple angles, where you have federal agents throwing this guy to the ground, disarming him first, and then seconds later shooting. It's not relevant. It's not a justification at all. And I mean, this is the thing, you know, the officials are not saying, oh, well, look, you know, maybe this is unfortunate, or, you know, maybe this was unwise, or they're saying, Kash Patel, you cannot bring a firearm to any sort of protest that you want. It's that simple. To do so would, quote, break the law. He is the head of the FBI. He is the Republican appointed head of the FBI. And that is flat wrong. How did we get in this position, Catherine?
I am having to do some deep breathing before I answer this question because of the quotes you just read. It's crazy. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Republicans thought the Second Amendment was really important. And it is genuinely a disorienting experience. I also think the thing that seems to be we're sort of like brushing past in this is this incident, as well as the one a few days earlier. They were both American citizens exercising their rights. And I think that that's the other piece of this, is this claim that we have heard over and over that, it's at base, it is the, if you didn't do anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about claim. And that has just proven spectacularly untrue. Like, particularly the Preddy case, like, it is very clear to me he didn't do anything wrong. And even if it later turns out that the exact sequence of events is different than what you just described at the beginning of this podcast, I don't think it will be very far off. And so we are left with a person who was exercising his right of assembly, who was exercising his Second Amendment rights, and who died for it. An American citizen.
I think it is at least plausible. We don't know all the details. You know, there hasn't been an investigation, which is one reason why people like Kristi Noem shouldn't be weighing in here with absolute certainty. But it's at least plausible to me, based on some of the videos that I've seen, that after he was disarmed, the gun that was pulled from him went off, probably accidentally, while it was in the hand of the agent that disarmed him. This is not a certainty. This is not something that I can say with great confidence, but it doesn't seem like a completely impossible sort of set of events. And then because that gun went off while the agents were shouting, gun, that is what triggered the other agents to fire. Now, even in that case, if that is true, then that is at very best an unfortunate but understandable mistake. I think in what I've read, I'm not an expert on law enforcement tactics and procedure, but what I've read is even in that case, it might still well be an unlawful killing. But that is the, I think, the most sort of sympathetic kind of steelman-y case you can make for the other side here. But that's not what we're hearing. That's not what we're hearing at all. Just another quote that I just like, again, you might need to take another deep breath here, Catherine. Here is Border Patrol Commander at Large Gregory Bovino, who's in charge of this situation, saying the Second Amendment doesn't apply, basically. We respect the Second Amendment right, but those rights don't count when you riot and assault, delay, obstruct, and impede law enforcement officers, and most especially when you mean to do that beforehand. And so this goes to, I think, the fundamental lie, Matt, that is just obviously untrue, which is that this guy was some sort of terrorist, an assassin out to massacre law enforcement agents. There is no evidence that that's true. It's, in fact, there's plenty of evidence that it's not. And yet that's the story that they went with.
Yeah, our short king, Gregory Bovino, said that it looked like Preddy wanted to do maximum damage and massacre law enforcement and that he assaulted federal officers. It's worth remembering, for those of us who haven't watched the video 75 times since Saturday, that this started when one of about six federal agents went over to a woman who was standing by the curb filming and shoved her with two hands so that she fell over backwards in the snow. Why was that good policing? I have an answer. It wasn't. It was lousy policing. What are you doing? You're shoving someone who's filming you. Why would you think that that's okay?
Not the first video we've seen of immigration enforcement agents shoving people or making physical contact just for filming. In fact, there was a press conference, pretty amazing, in Minneapolis last week, in which some police chiefs talked about how their own officers were being stopped, pulled over, often people of color. And in one case, tried to film the incident and had the phone knocked out of her hand by an immigration enforcement official. And they seem to think that they have the right to engage with people physically just because they're being filmed.
Do you know who are really, really pissed off right now? Cops. Cops are watching these penny ante schmoes out there with masks on as often as not, acting out their fantasies of being tough guy law enforcement in places that they haven't really enforced the law before, even if they've been on the force in their force for 8 years as the initial guy had been in ICE. But a lot of these guys are new hires because they hired a bunch of people at a time when police jurisdictions are having a difficult time hiring people. So imagine the standards that are being applied here. But are cops. I got a DM from a guy yesterday who describes himself as a back the blue MAGA type, senior leadership, NYPD. And he's like, everyone is pissed. I'm pissed. Everyone's pissed because they see this lousy policing. What are you doing on the streets? This is not something that cops who, by now, almost all in big cities, they're wearing cameras, unlike ICE. ICE is choosing not to wear cameras. And by ICE here, I mean, this is a deliberate choice by the administration. They could not wear masks. They could wear cameras. They could be doing this. They're choosing not to. And they're choosing to surge into cities one after the other. Why did we choose Los Angeles and then Portland and then Chicago and then Minneapolis? I would posit that part of this is that they chose those places because they were kind of hoping for some conflict. They've said this at various times. Trump has said this himself, that these are the places we're going to go into deep blue cities where they have sanctuary laws, which we can talk about separately. But we're going to go to these places and have these confrontations with law enforcement agents who were not trained for this and who have been given a sense of a little extra aggression in their boots. And they're out there shoving people who are filming them or filming them back and saying, good, I'm putting you on some like visual database here. This starts from the top and goes down. It is awful. And cops, the people who had been demonized 5 years ago for how they were, for how what happened in Minneapolis and elsewhere, they're some of the front lines criticizing, and rightly so, the Trump administration for this really, really reckless law enforcement that has now killed two U.S. citizens with zero criminal records. How many protesters were killed in 2020 by cops after the George Floyd riots, which were terrible riots, and maybe they definitely should have been policed more than they were? How many protesters were killed? Zero. And we've killed two people in Minneapolis this month.
John Lee, I want to ask you about the sanctuary city stuff since Matt brought that up. One of the arguments that you were hearing from administration types is that they're not quite saying this is all Tim Walz's fault, but they're saying that in some sense, Tim Walz bears some responsibility, that Democratic leaders in Minnesota bear responsibility for this because of two things. Basically, they've set up sanctuary city policies that protect illegal alien criminals, and two, then they don't cooperate with federal officials trying to pursue deportation in the city. And that is the reason that this keeps happening, and that it's Democrats' fault, not the fault of out of control Border Patrol and ICE agents here. How do you respond to that? What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, I mean, there's micro and macro, and I'm definitely much less libertarian on immigration than you all are. And so I think
so is everyone.
Yes. But I think in sanctuary cities, for example, like the American people, there's a reason a lot of immigration law is handled federally. The Lake and Riley case, that guy had come from New York. And so I think, you know, the American people deserve to have federal immigration law enforced in sanctuary cities. I think Donald Trump was elected on a platform of enforcing federal immigration law around the country. So, I get in a macro sense that there needs to be like significant enforcement of federal immigration law. Now, in a micro sense, does that absolve these ICE or CBP, actually, in this case, it was CBP officers in the streets of Minneapolis? It doesn't absolve anything, but I do think, yes, like the lieutenant governor of the DFL lieutenant governor of Minnesota was telling people to put their bodies on the line. And there's a charitable interpretation of that, which is to exercise civil disobedience. But millennial civil disobedience is becoming so insufferable because it's not your grandfather's civil disobedience.
Wait, aren't you a millennial?
Yes, I am a self-loathing right. millennial. But, you know, there's civil disobedience where you're saying I'm getting arrested to protest a law. And as I am getting arrested, I will say this law is unjust, and then I'll go out and talk with my attorney about how the law is unjust. But then there's civil disobedience, which is literally just for the sake of creating chaos to impede law enforcement and not to protest the law itself. And I think those are two different things. I think there's been some organized chaos in Minneapolis that is making things much less safe. If you go through, like, a Newsmax employee was infiltrating one of the hilarious signal groups of the anti-ICE activists. And in there, even the ICE activists say comply with the law enforcement when you're getting taken into custody for your own safety. And so I think, you know, that's important to reiterate and emphasize over and over again. And the situation seems to have been spiraling. Micro sense, it is not. It, of course, does not absolve the officers for, I agree with Peter's interpretation of this, reacting to the shot in the way that they did. That's what it seems to look like right now. But it's I have a lot of open questions about that, too.
But I don't think Alex Pretty was there to protest in a way that was designed to cause chaos, to impede immigration enforcement
like
actions. He was there to film, for sure. He was there, I think, to show that he didn't approve of this of government action. But until the force here, the human contact, as far as we can tell from the videos, was initiated by the immigration officer, by the CBP official who pushed the woman, that's when it started. And he stepped in to say, hey, don't do that, to put himself, not to attack, not to assault them, but basically just to say, this is not an appropriate thing for you to be doing to this lady. And it's not. And he was right in that. And it ended up costing him his life. And I don't even know, I mean, if you can fully buy the argument, even watching those videos, that he was really resisting arrest. Because by the time they start putting hands on him, right, like this is, it's a chaotic situation. It's not obvious that he's pushing back, that he's, you know, doing anything. Certainly he's not going for his weapon, anything like that. It does look like a scuffle. But again, even the argument that he was obviously resisting arrest does not seem correct to me here. Catherine, where do you think this goes? It sort of seems like the Trump administration came out real strong on Saturday with a very predefined narrative, but that was coming from the top officials. And now Trump himself is not taking quite as hard a line and maybe seems to be seeing, oh, look, this is not playing well, even with my own voters.
Yeah, I think so. Trump told the Journal, I don't like any shooting. I don't like it. But I don't like it when somebody goes into a protest and he's got a very powerful, fully loaded gun with two magazines loaded up with bullets. Also, that doesn't play good either. And I think that's like that word choice is interesting. Like that doesn't play good. And we will leave aside the grammatical. Does it play good or does it play well? Question. But
always the copy editor.
I was born this way, Peter. It's who I am.
I'm well aware.
But I think that it's the how is it playing question is like really coming forward right now. And I think Trump is sensitive to that because that is always his question is how is this playing? I don't know that we get a full taco situation. Like, I don't know that Trump is like, okay, well, actually, it turns out people don't love it that we keep shooting American citizens, during protests. So maybe we should stop. It might. But I think the other possible way that it plays out is what you saw in Kristi Noem's letter to Walz, where she cites.
Are you talking about the voter registration letter?
Yeah.
The strongly worded letter.
That's from Pam Bondi, sorry. I believe. Yes. I just want to make sure
Jesus
we get that
Christ,
right.
Jesus Christ, there's so many crazy people. Pam Bondi's letter to Walz about the conditions under which, right, they might back down, which is...
Right, so what she said in that letter is that if you turn over your voter registration data, we'll consider backing out of the immigration surge in Minneapolis. Suggesting that maybe all of this is just a front, or like not like just a front, but at least partially a front for gaining control of a blue state's voting apparatus.
I don't know about that. I mean, I that is an interpretation of this letter, and that's a totally weird request. But I also like I think by
it's
focusing
not that weird
on that
coming from this administration, which is obsessed with gaining control of voting infrastructure.
Yeah, I guess I am unwilling, based on what we have here, to draw the conclusion in the end this was all or somewhat about voter registration. But I did want to highlight another passage in that letter, which is where she says violence against ICE officers and agents has increased approximately 1,300% and vehicular attacks against ICE officers have increased 3,200%. Again, leaving aside why in God's name you would express it as 1,300%. This is a very, very classic, like if you start from a low base, the percentage increase is substantial. It sounds like ICE officers are the victims here in this telling. And I think that could be a very powerful story for some people. Like the idea that these heroes who are trying to enforce the law are out there under attack, is the other place that this could go. And I think the administration is kind of testing that and seeing if that's going to hit with the American people.
I mean, that goes to Matt's point about wanting a conflict and chaos here and sort of wanting that to play that up. And in fact, look, we should acknowledge in some cases, ICE officers have been attacked. There was a shooting in Washington, D.C. It wasn't ICE, but it was federal troops on the streets of Washington, D.C. Pretty bizarre situation. Doesn't really map onto sort of any obvious politics. But in fact, National Guardsmen have been shot and killed in the streets of Washington, D.C.
They were shot at in Dallas. There's that Dallas shooting, and it ended up hurting the migrants.
This is not completely made up out of whole cloth. At the same time, we also have two pretty obviously needless, let's say, even if not technically unlawful, completely needless killings of American citizens by immigration officials in the Minneapolis area in the space of less than a month here. And people don't like it. Matt, what do you make of the polls here and sort of the kind of shifting winds in terms of the public? I mean, there's a New York Times poll. This was before the Preddy killing, but after Rene Good, just 36% of voters said they approved of the way ICE was handling its job, while 63% disapproved, including 70% of independent voters. 61% of voters said ICE had gone too far in their tactics, including 20% or so of Republicans. I mean, people don't like this. This is, to Catherine's point, or to Trump's, not playing well.
Yeah, it's not. And it gives the lie to J.D. Vance. Remember when he went to soothe tensions in Minneapolis last week? That was fun. And in that, his
hand, I think Catherine is still tense.
I can't. It didn't work. I am unsoothed.
Attempt to do anything. The vice president of the United States said that the people out there protesting just don't want us to have a border. What he's trying to do there is a public opinion sleight of hand, that basically 70-30 issue, as you just portrayed it, you could say, you know, 67-33, if you prefer, is different than the percentage of Americans who do want immigration enforced, the border controlled, and especially criminals, the worst of the worst, deported. That's a good issue for Trump. The off-ramp right now that's being proposed between Trump and Tim Walz, who had a very perfect phone call, I think, earlier today, that they're all tweeting about, is that per Trump, and I don't see Walz having confirmed this yet, but said that he was willing to kind of do some information sharing with criminals that are under the supervision of Minnesota and or Minneapolis. This has always been the grand bargain that Americans would totally get behind, regardless of whether libertarians all agree on it or not. David Beer at the Cato Institute has been doing a lot of research about who is getting arrested and deported, who are the worst of the worst. And in his headline number is that something like 75% of the people that have been rounded up as of recently basically have no criminal record aside from violating immigration law. So it's not the worst of the worst at all. There is a percentage there, though, that is or comes from literally the Department of Homeland Security's Worst of the Worst database. That's 3.5%. Of those, about 2 out of 3 are either violent crimes or property crimes, so which would be about 2%. 2% of the people total that are being detained by or arrested by Border Patrol or ICE seem to be violent criminals or people like stealing property who kind of deserve to be deported. Why weren't they already? And part of the reason why is because of sanctuary cities and different policies that mostly Democratic jurisdictions have to not share information about the immigration status of the people who've been convicted in some cases of crimes. I think you would have a solid majority if Trump wanted to spend his political capital just zeroing in on that. He would, I think. And it'd be pretty interesting and put Democrats on their back heels and we could have an interesting national conversation. That is not what the choice has been up until now. One would hope that's where it goes next. But now that everybody's completely inflamed and we're in this thermostatic nightmare, and I only use that word because I don't know what it means, but where everyone's being provoked into reaction against one another, it makes it kind of difficult to imagine how that little sensible sliver could be the off-ramp. But I'm hoping it is.
This is, by the way, like J.D. Vance loves to do this.
Thermostat, same deal.
Thermostats. J.D. Vance loves to do this thing over and over, actually. This is one of his favorite rhetorical moves where he says like, oh, so you're saying we shouldn't have any laws at all? And he did that with the...
Catherine, though, you are. This is
I was going to say.
Catherine Mengu Ward, self-proclaimed philosophical anarchist, is in fact saying maybe we shouldn't have any laws at all.
Yeah. So but for not example... He was talking about that, you know, the cute little 5-year-old in the hat that that there was the images of a kid being taken into custody. And there's he said, if the argument is that you can't arrest people who have violated our laws because they have children, then every single parent is going to be completely given immunity from ever being the subject of law enforcement. That doesn't make any sense. He's right. That doesn't make any sense. That is not why people were kind of flipping out about the image of the five-year-old with his little backpack. And I think, you know, it's that like choice to be purposefully obtuse and to say like, oh, so you're saying thing you're definitely not saying. You know, the idea that that would somehow calm tensions or like bring peace, like he is not well suited to the task.
Emily, I want to ask you about what Matt was talking about with Trump's opportunity when it comes to immigration, where like the polls show pretty clearly, or at least did show up until relatively recently, that the public was on Republican side when it came to the idea of immigration enforcement, even if they were not happy with what they were seeing in terms of ICE tactics. So I have a sort of a 1.5 part question here, which is basically just, is there any realistic way to do large scale immigration enforcement without this sort of tragedy recurring, without these sort of tactics? And when I say realistic, I mean with Donald Trump in charge, because Donald Trump is somebody who picks people like Stephen Miller, who picks people like Kristi Noem, who picks that class of person to run his operations. And Miller in particular seems to relish this sort of thing and actually loves seeing those tactics on TV.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I was just thinking about as Catherine was talking, because the definition of large scale, I don't think is agreed upon within the administration, because I think Stephen Miller has a different definition than honestly even Donald Trump himself. And part of the trade-off is that they've been using these scare tactics intentionally to get people to self-deport. And I actually think their self-deportation program is very clever and has been. I mean, they have like, they say 2 million people have self-deported because they're helping with plane tickets, $1,000 bonus. And I think that's a really good way to do things. Do you need these fear-mongering tactics to drive people to do that? I actually don't think you do. I think they should start, you know, enforcing the law on employers much more stringently than they have been, like doing these meatpacking plants where the conditions are super dangerous. There's potentially child labor, although maybe we could have a discussion about child labor law. Might be on your guys' side on that one.
The child labor laws is probably a little far afield for this podcast, but I do want to push back just a little bit, because when we saw the National Guard deployed, we saw immigration enforcement be ramped up in Los Angeles. That is where we started seeing these raids on workplaces. And even folks like Joe Rogan, who I think of as a pretty good bellwether for a kind of independent-y, Trumpy type voter who is in favor of some types of immigration enforcement, but is really put off by what he's seeing on television and on social media right now. Even Joe Rogan was like, these people are just working. They just came here to work. This is not what we're here to do. When I said I wanted immigration enforcement, I wanted them to go after the actual bad guys, that very small percentage that Matt Welch was talking about, not the people at the meatpacking plants, because those people are just here to do a job. And also when you fire the people at the meatpacking plants, why do you think grocery bills are going up?
Well, I would love to see, and I think the American public would actually probably support watching white collar criminals be handcuffed because they knew exactly what they were doing. And they knew that their margins were exactly where they were because of what they were doing. And I think there are probably a lot of cases that you could find like that. So just the politics of it, I think, are easier in that respect. I think the self-deportation policies are easier in that respect. But I think the Trump administration and Stephen Miller being the architect of this has decided that every time they heighten the contradictions, because the public, to quote Lenin, because the public hates the left more than it hates the right, when they see, this is their calculation, when they see chaos in the streets, because the public has this just like revulsion to chaos, this is what they believe, then they're going to ultimately win in the political cost-benefit analysis. Now, the problem with that is if they think, and this was different in 2020, if they think the administration is causing the chaos itself, which you see in the Preddy video potentially playing out, that becomes a huge political issue for the Trump administration. And I wonder if actually Trump is aware of that, and it's part of the reason that he feels like the optics aren't good.
I'm just not sure that there is a realistic alternative to this sort of enforcement in the Trump administration, in the Republican Party that we have right now, which kind of wild eyes for this sort of confrontation, which you know, has hired up all of these immigration enforcement agents, like Matt has said, people who in many cases were wanted to be cops and were failed cops, either fired or couldn't get through the application process. You're just going to end up having trouble with a team like that. And you're going to especially have trouble with a team like that when it's led by people like Greg Bovino and it runs up to Christy Noem and Stephen Miller at the top. Matt Welch, Catherine, I take it you don't agree with Emily's desire to see white collar criminals, to see is people locked up here. Just how do you respond to that? Sort of how, what's the libertarian take on all this?
Yeah, Catherine.
I mean, I think part of, you know, what we should take seriously is Emily was describing what she thinks the American people would like to see also. I think that is important here. Like, not to be this guy, but like, I would like to see the law enforced consistently and fairly. And I think that is, I would like the laws to be better. And I don't think it should be illegal to employ people who came here without the right pile of paperwork. But I also think that when we have this kind of seemingly politicized, semi-random enforcement of immigration law, right? Like, okay, we're just going to go into a city and suddenly have a really, really high standard for immigration enforcement, totally different from the one that has preceded it for many years or many decades in some cases. That is, you know, that's something libertarians should oppose, not just on the grounds of like, oh, this is undergirded by bad immigration policy, which I think it is, but also we think there should be equal enforcement. We think that there should be predictable and just and boring enforcement of the laws. And this is the opposite. This is like exciting, jazzy, politicized enforcement of the laws. The Trump administration was making a bet that people would like that, but people don't like that, including, you know, people who are not dumb libertarians, but also just regular people. They want to see the laws enforced. And so sometimes you get, I want to see the laws enforced and people crossed the border and broke the law, therefore kick them out. But I think the slightly more subtle version of this is, gee, maybe we should have laws that can be enforced without getting to this impasse. Maybe we should have laws that are enforceable without shooting American citizens who have their constitutionally protected firearm on their hip in the street.
And Peter,
and I also just wanted Congress to do something.
I just wanted, that's exactly right. And I just wanted to quickly add, this is the thing, like the notion that you can just, I mean, I don't know, like the part of the problem for me is that a lot of this on the right scapegoats foreigners when so much of the problem is just Americans ourselves have like created a horrible immigration system and there are people who exploit it. And it's just much easier politically to scapegoat the foreigners than it is to, like Catherine was saying, enforce across the board.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to Catherine, to your point, part of, and in some ways also to Emily's, part of what we are seeing here is like the inverse, the sort of evil twin of the Democrats' approach to immigration policy under Joe Biden, where their worldview cashed out to, they never said these words, but it cashed out to, we don't want to change the law. We also don't want to enforce it. And now what we have is we're still not going to change the law, but we are going to enforce it. I wouldn't say excitingly and jazzily. Those are not the words I would use. I would say maybe horrifically and in a dysfunctional manner that makes everyone mad and also doesn't even achieve its stated goals. But like they're sort of doing it in a kind of maximalist way rather than the Democrats' approach of not changing the laws and not doing it and also not doing anything about it.
This is what Justin Amash was tweeting about this week is, you know, get ready for when these same irregularly enforced laws are in the hands of the next Democratic administration and they come after everyone with a Gadsden flag and everyone who, you know, says boo in a way
and
that
everyone who is carrying a gun to a protest.
To the March for Life.
And
if you're carrying the March for Life.
Sure. Yeah. And I think
and they're going to be able to throw the Republican FBI director's words back in the faces of the people who are there. They're going to be able to throw Scott Bessent's words back at Republicans. He's saying, well, of course, you know, basically he brought this on him. It's unfortunate, but he's basically saying Pretty brought this on himself by carrying a gun that was loaded and an extra magazine.
I mean, this is Bovino said, the suspect did bring a weapon, a loaded 9mm high-capacity handgun, to a riot. And as Reason's own Jacob Sullum pointed out in an excellent write-up of this whole situation, almost every phrase in that is contentious. Like, first of all, suspect, like, suspected of what, friend? Second, high-capacity handgun, like, that's the standard magazine. What do you mean by that phrase? And then finally, and most importantly, a riot, right? And this has been an issue up for debate since at least the summer of 2020, and also since at least 1972, and also since at least the founding. But, you know, if you just call any gathering of people a riot and then all your constitutionally protected rights go away, we are in a bad, bad situation. And that can go against the right just as much as the left.
Just as Jacob also underscored in that and other pieces, as CJ Sharamala, whose name I'm never going to pronounce correctly, is that all this prejudging by the officials who are up at the top of the relevant agencies, in the top of the White House even, underscores that we cannot trust those same people to investigate this incident. We've heard from the last 24 hours, we don't know the names of the cops involved. That's weird. They're still on the force. They're still out there. They're not taking a 30-day timeout, which you would normally do if you were
an
actual cop.
They've apparently been transferred out of the area.
All right. Okay. But maybe you should be transferred into a timeout as we investigate this. There's no reason to trust the federal investigation of a federal shooting of a man like a dog on the street. That is a really bad place to be right now. The Trump administration gutted the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties under the Department of Homeland Security, which would normally be doing that kind of investigation. So what do we do now? And they have been kind of actively thwarting other law enforcement agencies that are not under their control from having the ability to investigate this stuff. That is dark, dark, dark place to be right now.
Well, the place we are at right now is that Congress does seem like maybe they are, I don't know if they're going to do something, but there's at least some Republicans calling for real investigations here. And while it's certainly not a majority of them, it's some, and that's heartening. And this week also is, like every week in Congress, it's budget week. It's budget week. Remember we had a government shutdown a couple of months ago, and they got the government back open until the end of January. And that's the end of this week, which means this might hold up the next budget deal or budget extension here. We might end up with a government shutdown because of this in coming weeks. We'll talk about that next week if that's what happens. But we've got to move on. Before we go, just want to say that if you like the Reason Roundtable and want to hear us talk more about this and many other topics, you can come see us live in Washington, D.C. next week. Matt Welch, Catherine Mangy Ward, and a triumphantly returning Nick Gillespie, and yours truly, will all be live and on stage at the D.C. Improv. We're going to talk about the news. I'm going to talk about Matt Welch's favorite city, Washington, D.C. That's right. There's going to be a whole Matt Welch Loves Washington segment. I'm telling you right now. It's not really. Not really. It's I'm tempted. And we're going to take your questions. It's all happening next week, Wednesday, February 4th at the DC Improv. Get more information and tickets at reason.com/events. That is reason.com/events. And now it is time for a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have a listener question about how to protest immigration enforcement, even if you are not a left-wing progressive.
It's a snow day here in Washington, D.C., and if you're like me, you like to spend your snow days in bed as much as possible. So once you're done with your shoveling and you want to climb into bed, I suggest that you do what I did and get cozy on your Brooklyn bedding mattress. The folks at Brooklyn Bedding were nice enough to send me one a while back. I've been using it for months. I really recommend it. I actually got the Aurora Lux cooling mattress, so I was able to test it under the very important cold conditions, and I can report that it is also a warm and cozy mattress, if that is what you need in the moment. I really appreciate the fact that it's kind of a good all-around mattress. It's not too soft, it's not too firm, and if you want to get one for yourself, you can use Reason's promo code. You get 30% off if you go to brooklynbedding.com and put in the code Reason. It also helps support this podcast.
All right, folks, a reminder, we do love to answer your questions as long as they're short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long. If you want us to consider your question, please send an email to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. This week's question comes from Michael, who writes, I went to a small protest this weekend in Tacoma, Washington, because I, too, am horrified by and worried about the violence at the hands of federal officers in Minneapolis. Protest was put on by the local chapter of the DSA and various other left-leaning groups, and I found myself disagreeing with a lot of the messaging, but I also wanted to be there in solidarity with the big message. Armed federal thugs shooting people in the streets of U.S. cities is unequivocally bad. As a sometimes right-leaning, sometimes left-leaning centrist who is definitely not a progressive leftist, how can I support the cause without tacitly endorsing all of the progressive left's other ideas? Catherine, what do you say?
Got to write a really, really good sign. I mean, I'm sort of kidding, but I'm sort of not kidding. Like, everybody understands that the way that kind of protesting works in the modern era is that there's often a single thing that brings people together, and then it exerts this kind of magnetic pull on whatever random grievances people have. I mean, I remember, when I was first kind of politically aware, every protest had a free Mumia guy at it. Sometimes a lot of guys, I don't know. That was just a thing that people did at every protest. You just didn't worry about it too much.
Was there ever a free Mumia gal?
Or gal.
Yes. Yes, yes.
So I think that, you know,
non-gender-specific guys.
We don't believe in guilt by association when it comes to protests, right? Like, the whole thing about it is like, everybody's just there exercising their right to speech and assembly. And just because you stand next to somebody who's got their red rose or their end capitalism or whatever it is, you just got to write your sign to say what you think and hold it up and be content that you did the right thing. Like, I actually don't think it's a hard question. I guess the sort of expert level answer would also be like, do things besides just standing around in the cold. And I say that as someone who does not do a lot of political activism via standing around in the cold. In fact, none. But who is, I would like to think, doing my part to get my sense of what is just and what is unjust out there into the world. There are many, many ways to do that, including, you know, your good old traditional letters to the editor of your local paper and all kinds of stuff like that. Not to be a cheeseball about it, but the more words you can use to express your point, the more clearly you can convey who you're with and who you're not with.
You don't need to stand in the cold because there's so much cold in your heart.
True. Yeah. I always am standing in the cold, in a sense.
Yeah. Emily, so you're definitely not a progressive leftist. I feel confident in, I self-define however you want, but I feel confident in this. But what do you think about this question? And is the answer maybe go to the leftist protest with a completely, perfectly legal weapon?
Oh, hell yeah. First of all, because these could be dangerous situations. And I think if you are a good guy with a gun, that's great. Second of all, I always say the most hillbilly thing about J.D. Vance is actually that leaked email he had about how he hates the cops. Like, I feel like this way around conservatives all the time. I'm like, that, that's hashtag back the blue, of course. But anyway, some of these people would have put you in camps or shot you during COVID. Yes, probably. Who knows? But or the future COVID. But the point of doing these types of things and talking to people who disagree with you is that maybe you can convince them not to be the jackbooted thugs that they so despise on the other side when the table turns during another pandemic or God knows what else could be coming down the pipeline. So I think it's great. Like, go talk to them and have good relationships with them, and they'll think of you when they're considering whether or not to put us in camps during the next pandemic.
I think that's a good answer. It terrified me about the camps, though. Nobody likes camp. Matt Welch.
I remember going in 2000, right before during the Democratic National Convention in the beautiful town of Los Angeles, California. There was a big protest that I went to, or biggish protest that I went to, kind of in solidarity, that was organized in protest of a huge LAPD scandal called the Rampart Scandal. Fun fact, which was all about immigration enforcement, but this rogue unit of anti-gang unit, which then made a lot of great movies based on it, had done horrible things in immigrant communities around MacArthur Park and elsewhere. And so I went there like, all right, okay, I'm mad about the cops too right now and all that. And then there was the free Mumia. I forget if it was a guy or a gal, but there was one. And then a woman I recognized as a documentary filmmaker who is specialized in pro-Castro agitprop, and I had just come from Cuba, and I'd actually hung out with her a little bit there, was talking about how great and how just Fidel Castro was at a rally about bad cops. And it's just like, okay, this life is not for me. I'm going to express my my ideas about civil libertarian objections to over-policing in different venues, which is my advice too. Never go to a protest looking for political wisdom. You're never going to find it. If you do, it's going to be by accident on a sign that Catherine Mangu Ward wrote herself, hopefully with a little picture and her terrible, terrible fingers. There are a lot of different ways, a lot of different organizations out there doing the Lord's work who are probably doing some non-profit-y type of work that is specifically trying to help the people that you are truly in solidarity with in this case. Ones that I would name, these are super libertarian-y, so take that for what it's worth, but like the Institute for Justice, Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, and such like. But there's definitely going to be some good organizations out there who are doing work in there. Find them, help them. There's more than one way to register your dissatisfaction and to actually help people who are in need.
All right. So speaking of places that you should not go looking for political wisdom, let's talk about the movies because the Oscar nominations were released this week. Right. So this this year, I think every year there's sort of talk about politics at the Oscars. But this year, I think it's even more direct and in your face because it's been clear for months now. It's been clear for a while that if you're paying attention to this, that one battle after another, which is this Paul Thomas Anderson movie about an ex-violent radical played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who is ends up embroiled in a racist government plot to do immigration enforcement and come after his daughter. I mean, it's very complicated, the whole middle act of the film, the whole middle section is basically a giant immigration raid in which Leonardo DiCaprio, high off of his gourd, must escape a town in California with the help of Benicio del Toro, who is basically running a sanctuary city. I had issues with this movie, but Benicio del Toro is very charming in it. There's a bunch of great filmmaking. I mean, it's incredibly well crafted. There's just a killer action sequence at the end of it, a sequence that they have called the River of Hills sequence. Just so good, sort of shows you exactly the things you need to see to surprise you right in the moment. But if there's competition for Best Picture, I think it's Ryan Coogler's Sinners, which is, in a lot of ways, it's just a vampire movie, right? It's a Southern Gothic vampire film, but it is also a very political film in its own way, sort of set in one of these corporate towns where the black residents are being paid entirely in chits, right? And they sort of can't have, they're not going to ever be able to save up enough to have their own things, right? So my first question is, have you guys seen either of these movies or the other Best Picture nominees? Anybody here? No?
The only movie I saw at the movie theater this year was Zootopia 2, and that will be the beginning and end of my Oscars commentary. Thank you.
Okay, we'll leave it there then.
Yeah, I haven't seen. I'm looking at these now. I haven't seen them.
I saw the One Battle After Another, and my general take on its politics, or that most people got its politics wrong. My interpretation of the movie is that it is actually encouraging people to disengage with politics and take care of their family, which is also the same takeaway from Marty Supreme. Frankly,
I'm not sure I totally agree with that. And here is why, because the ending of that movie. So Leonardo DiCaprio, like I said, plays an ex-violent leftist radical. He was a bomber in this movie's schema, right? Working as part of a group called the French 75, which is a very good cocktail. So this is right. He hasn't he's now, for most of the movie after the first act, he's in hiding. And this is sort of the fact that this sort of racist immigration squad run through the government, but also with a sort of private KKK-like club called the Christmas Adventurers Club. I promise I'm not making this up, right? Gets wind of where he and his daughter are at, and then he goes on the run, is what kicks a lot of the plot into the movie. But this is, right, he is out there trying to find and save his daughter. And at the end of the movie, his daughter is the one who saves the two of them, not him. He kind of shows up on the scene late, and she is the one with the gun who has done the work that needs to be done to keep that family safe. And then what happens at the very, very end of that movie, Matt, is they're sitting in their little house and they realize that there is a protest several hours away. And she puts on her jacket and kind of walks off, and the music swells. And he's so proud of her because she's continuing the work, because she is part of the protest legacy of his life, a legacy that the movie like wants to have it both ways in so many ways, right? Like this is a movie about a guy who was a bomber, a guy who was a violent radical leftist. And it doesn't quite want to say that that violence is great, but it does want to say, you know what? It's really good when you pass this on to your children. Isn't
well,
that
when
wonderful
the children presumably aren't bombing. And let's not forget that the emotional resonance in that scene is not about her going to a protest. It's about her reading a letter that he finds from the mom. And I'm sorry we're going into the weeds of a movie here, but Peter asked the question, so I'm going to answer it. Reveals a letter that her estranged revolutionary mom wrote to her. And she sort of then like hugs the hapless dad who, you know, life. His wardrobe is my lifetime aspiration goals.
He basically dresses like the dude in The Big Lebowski.
Just fantastic. But
always in a robe, right?
The best interpretation, I think, is that he made up that letter.
I've heard that. But that's not in the text of the film. You have to imagine that.
You're talking
and
about politics.
Also,
and I'm saying is that like the payoff isn't going to the protest. The payoff is my dad is doing what it takes to make me feel good. And he's choosing family instead of choosing this screw off revolutionary life.
What if we think of
explicitly anti-political message?
But what if we think of Marty Supreme as a sequel to One Battle After Another?
I think that's totally fair. Or the prequel, even.
It would have to be a prequel because Marty Supreme is definitely set in the 1950s. And One
just
Battle
that the
After
conditions
Another is set in
for
some
competitive
sort of alternative quasi-presence.
No, both are explicitly pro-family movies, and I'm here for it.
Emily, I know you end up doing a lot of cultural commentary. I guess you haven't seen these movies, but sort of in terms of the Oscars and politics, I mean, is it inevitable that these films, that the awards end up going to films for political reasons rather than for artistic reasons?
I don't know. I mean, my specialty is middlebrow, which is why I haven't seen these films. But I think we could be surprised this year. But even like, I just don't like the separation between the politics and the art. Like categorically, I think the art, if it's artful, if the politics are artful, then I have no problem with them awarding something like that. But yeah, I mean, a lot of times it feels like a virtue signal, you know, giving something an award that's totally unworthy of it because it makes a kind of a political point that fits the Hollywood narrative. But Hollywood right now is a political muddle. It's, you know, you've got David Ellison out there. You've got all these guys who are trying to figure out where the wind is blowing. So I think we could be maybe in for a surprise this year.
I like surprises. I will say I wrote a fairly critical piece about One Battle After Another when it came out, and I stand by it to some extent, but I watched it again. And that tells you something. Just the fact that I went back and watched it again, and I watched it again, and my position softened on that movie somewhat. It's really pretty remarkably well made. And so is Sinners. Sinners is a great movie. Strongly recommend both of them if you like, you know, good movies. All right, let's move on to our final segment, our cultural recommendations, what we have been watching, reading, and otherwise consuming in the cultural realm. Catherine Mangy Ward, since you don't have any Oscar thoughts, let's start with you.
I'm a little mad, actually. I didn't get to talk about how the fact that the main character in Zootopia 2 are cops really reflects on our current... No, I'm just kidding. It's snowing. It's snowing a lot in a lot of places. It's snowing at my house, which is why I'm recording from my house. And I maybe like subconsciously for that reason started and am now completely obsessed with Dan Simmons's The Terror, which I think has been made into a show or something. I didn't know that. I only knew that last week Robbie Suave informed me that there was a Dan Simmons book that I hadn't read. And so I immediately bought it. I'm both reading it and listening to it. And I really strongly, strongly recommend this book, even though I'm only like one bazillionth of the way through because it's really, really long. It is about the men on board the HMS Terror, which is part of the Franklin expedition. They're looking for the Northwest Passage. They're stuck in the ice. There's lots of eerie wind. There's lots of creaking on the against the hull of the ship. Everyone's real hungry. Their noses keep being about to fall off. And it just feels really relatable to me because I am gonna have to shovel a little bit this afternoon, which is kind of the same thing, if we're being honest. It's gonna be like a little chilly.
Just put your heater out on the sidewalk.
Yeah. I love, love, love Dan Simmons. And I don't know why I didn't know about this book. I guess it is a historical novel, but it has the feeling that it might be diverging from well-established history in some ways. I will keep you posted in like a month and a half when I finish this book because it's long. But I'm going to go ahead and recommend it. The Terror by Dan Simmons for your second polar vortex snowstorm coming this weekend.
The first season of the TV show is pretty good. The second season, not quite as good. But I take it you're a big Hyperion fan.
Yeah. The like bizarre layering of Hyperion and Endymion, where it's like, it's The Tempest, but it's also Canterbury Tales, but it's also science fiction, but it's also like, absolutely love that. And I'm already loving a sort of a very different Dan Simmons that I'm finding in this book.
If we're going to adhere to the schema of that book, then whoever delivers the final podcast recommendation, the final recommendation here ends up being The Shrike, because every one of those stories is just like, you get something happens, and then you end up with the Shrike monster, which is a crazy spike monster. Matt Welch, do you want to tell us what you've been reading, watching, otherwise consuming? I hope that it involves a spike monster.
Does not. So I was Netflix surfing a couple weeks back, and came upon something I hadn't heard of. It seemed to be perfect, called Breakdown 1975. It's going to be about how the country was sort of collapsing, but Hollywood was producing all this kind of good independent artsy cinema, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Dog Day Afternoon and all that good stuff. And it's narrated by Jodie Foster. Kind of what's not to love. All right, you got me. You're going to show me a bunch of clips from a bunch of movies that I love that resonate with me. And I'm here to tell you, it's infuriating. Like it should be. It's a layup,
which is what you needed this weekend, right?
It wasn't this weekend. Thank God. We have infuriations enough. What's infuriating is sort of the conclusion. Like, it's fine. You're telling the same story that was in that book. Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, almost 30 years ago now, just about the new Hollywood generation and whatever. But it's set against the backdrop of sort of like mid 70s bicentennial-ish collapse that I was lucky enough to live through. And that's fine. And here we go. And it's the new generation. And then it sets it up so that like the end of the story is that this wonderful fermenty creative period ended because of the tyranny of Rocky. It's like, wait a second, what? 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 It's like, oh, we used to have these great independent movies and then Rocky came. Wait, this is the greatest independent movie story ever. What are you even talking about here? And the idea is that, oh, you needed like a patriotic guy and then like a happy ending instead of all the sad endings that we've been having.
Sorry, Rocky? Really? That's the villain?
Rocky and sort of like a reassertive patriotism and then like Reagan. Like it just gets suddenly so stupidly political. No, it's so stupid. It is so stupid. And then like Jodie Foster's nice Jodie Foster voice somehow now has turned against you. You're like, damn it, Jodie Foster. How dare you? I'm looking at her.
The story for the end of New Hollywood that I've always heard is that it was basically ended by a combination of Jaws and Star Wars, which showed that you could make giant piles of money off of a single movie.
In fairness, that's also
part of it. And then also Heaven's Gate, which is the Michael Cimino follow-up to The Deer Hunter that was just famously over budget, like 17 hours long. No one's ever really seen it, even though there is a Criterion edition, but I don't think the guy who did the transfer actually watched the movie, right? Like, it's famous, incredibly expensive auteurist disaster in the early 1980s that ended that period where all the executives were like, we're never doing that again. But it wasn't political. It was entirely for business reasons. And it had nothing to do with Rocky.
Yeah. And also not nearly enough cocaine to talk about how like these people kind of sort of screwed up the momentum that they had in the 70s. And it's done by this guy, Morgan Neville, who's done great documentaries. He did the Mr. Rogers one that he did 20 Feet from Stardom, which is awesome. He's exactly my age, so I knew what he was getting at. And it's just a disappointment. Make better documentaries. The end.
Emily, do you have something middle brow for us?
You know, I was going to recommend Palme Royale because I know a lot of people who gave up on the second season, but I think it was even better than the first. Instead, though, I'm going to feed you guys some libertarian catnip. And when you're snowed in, I always find that to be a good opportunity because you have so much time in front of you to go through like the list of things you haven't seen. So I was 7 in the year 2000. And we went back and watched The Smartest Guys in the Room. So the documentary on Enron, obviously. And as soon as it finished, I did what I often do when I'm trying to get a dissident's perspective on something in relatively modern history. And I typed in Enron, Ron Paul. And because my first boss in journalism was Tim Carney, my head's exploding because I'm just looking at all of the records of like export import bank money given to Enron over the years in the 1990s in the Clinton administration and thinking it's funny how this was not mentioned once, but the Bushes were, of course, mentioned, you know, dozens of times in the movie. And that was my experience with Smartest Guys in the Room on Saturday night as the snow was falling.
Yeah, it's almost like out of control regulatory agencies that aren't really, you know, that nobody has like pays attention to or audits or gets into anything. And everybody just kind of tacitly agrees to fund for no good reason every single year. Almost like that's bad. It creates a lot of problems that people don't pay attention to.
The problem is capitalism, Peter.
Oh, good point.
I heard that. Which is actually the thesis of what I'm going to recommend. Funny enough, I've been playing a video game called The Outer Worlds 2. This is a sequel. But this is a far future sort of shooter, RPG, role-playing game, video game. But it's set in a future in an alternate timeline in which William McKinley was never assassinated. Right. Ooh. So you know that you're playing a good video game when that's the premise of the of your shooter sci-fi video game. And the result was that Theodore Roosevelt was never president, and thus the trust busting of America's early 20th century never happened. So now we're in this future, which is just totally run by these giant sprawling mega corporations, including in the previous game, you had Auntie's something and Spacer's Choice. And there was a war going on between the two big corporations in the previous game. And now they've joined and now they're Auntie's Choice. And they're just one giant, like mega corporation capitalist faction. But that they're fighting off now a bunch of groups with other worldviews who you can sort of do jobs for and sometimes kill and sometimes be friends with folks who have sort of religious worldviews or a more authoritarian bent. There's one group that's like, we worship math. And another one that's like all these crazy space phenomena that are happening, that are part of the plot engine for the game. They're kind of like our mystical gods and we're going to become cultists around them. You befriend people. Sometimes you don't befriend people. You shoot them in the face. You do a lot of talking. You buy a lot of things. You sell stuff. You make guns. It's really kind of wonderful. The satire of corporations is so over the top that it kind of that it doesn't bother me at all because it's actually kind of funny and sort of so pointedly ridiculous. But also, if you want to take it seriously as a satire of corporations, and this is a thing that I think happens a lot when you get to sort of farces about big corporate control, is that they all end up sort of telling stories about worlds in which corporations are so powerful that they're not just corporations anymore. They're functionally governments. They control territory. They have armed forces. They tax you. They shoot you when you don't comply, more or less. Maybe they have some different words for it, but that's basically what it, right? And that's what's happening here. And it's like, okay, what you actually hate is a big authoritarian government, not a big corporation. It's a great, fun game. There's like there's a sort of depot kind of central area that you go to between missions in a space station. It's called Free Market Station. They had some problems there, actually. It actually kind of crashed, right? As you got to figure out what went on there. But this is a, it's a, it is actually, this is a great thing to do on a snow day because these games take dozens and dozens of hours. I have played already, my counter, and it tells you how many hours you played. So my counter says variously 23 hours to 2 days, depending on which counter you look at, which, and I don't even know that I'm halfway through the game yet. But if you have a snow day and an Xbox, The Outer Worlds 2, strongly recommend it. All right, folks, that is our show. Reminder, we have a Reason Roundtable live next week. You can find out more at reason.com/events. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.